Ferment cum, whose agonizing outreach to every part of the body makes a real cure chimerical, since what is but an accident, but a symptom of the main disease is so violent that the physician must attend the cure of that, rather than the cure of the disease itself, and whose consequence is abandonment. As sickness is the greatest misery, so the greatest misery of sickness is solitude. When the infectiousness of the disease deters them who should assist from coming, even the physician dares scarce come. It is an outlawry, an excommunication upon the patient. In pre-modern medicine, illness is described as it is experienced intuitively, as a relation of outside and inside, an interior sensation or something to be discerned on the body's surface, by sight, or just below, by listening, palpating, which is confirmed when the interior is opened viewing, in surgery, in autopsy. Modern, that is, effective medicine is characterized by far more complex notions of what is to be observed inside the body, not just the disease's results, damaged organs, but its cause, microorganisms, and by a far more intricate typology of illness. In the older era of artisanal diagnoses, being examined produced an immediate verdict, immediate as the physician's willingness to speak. Now an examination means tests, and being tested introduces a time lapse that, given the unavoidably industrial character of competent medical testing, can stretch out for weeks, an agonizing delay for those who think they are awaiting a death sentence or an acquittal. Many are reluctant to be tested out of dread of the verdict, out of fear of being put on a list that could bring future discrimination or worse, and out of fatalism. What good would it do? The usefulness of self-examination for the early detection of certain common cancers, much less likely to be fatal if treated before they are very advanced, is now widely understood. Early detection of an illness thought to be inexorable and incurable cannot seem to bring any advantage. Like other diseases that arouse feelings of shame, AIDS is often a secret, but not from the patient. A cancer diagnosis was frequently concealed from patients by their families. An AIDS diagnosis is at least as often concealed from the families by patients. And as with other grave illnesses regarded as more than just illnesses, many people with AIDS are drawn to whole body rather than illness-specific treatments, which are thought to be either ineffectual or too dangerous. The disparagement of effective scientific medicine for offering treatments that are merely illness-specific and likely to be toxic is a recurrent misconjecture of opinion that regards itself as enlightened. This disastrous choice is still being made by some people with cancer, an illness that surgery and drugs can often cure. And a predictable mix of superstition and resignation is leading some people with AIDS to refuse antiviral chemotherapy, which, even in the absence of a cure, has proved of some effectiveness in slowing down the syndrome's progress and in staving off some common presenting illnesses, and instead to seek to heal themselves, often under the auspices of some alternative medicine guru. But subjecting an emaciated body to the purification of a macrobiotic diet is about as helpful in treating AIDS as having oneself bled, the holistic medical treatment of choice in the era of Dunn. 4. Etymologically, patient means sufferer. It is not suffering as such that is most deeply feared, but suffering that degrades. That illness can be not only an epic of suffering, but the occasion of some kind of self-transcendence is affirmed by sentimental literature, and, more convincingly, by case histories offered by doctor writers. Some illnesses seem more apt than others for this kind of meditation. Oliver Sacks uses catastrophic neurological illness as the material for his portraits of suffering and self-transcendence, diminishment and exaltation. His great forerunner, Sir Thomas Browne, used tuberculosis for a similar purpose, to ruminate about illness in general, in A Letter to a Friend, upon occasion of the death of his intimate friend, 1657, making pre-romantic sense out of some of the familiar stereotypes about tuberculosis, that it is a distinctive manner of being ill. this being a lingering disease, and a distinctive manner of dying, his soft death. A fiction about soft or easy deaths. In fact, dying of tuberculosis was often hard and extremely painful, is part of the mythology of most diseases that are not considered shameful or demeaning. In contrast to the soft death imputed to tuberculosis, AIDS, like cancer, leads to a hard death. The metaphorized illnesses that haunt the collective imagination are all hard deaths, or envisaged as such. Being deadly is not in itself enough to produce terror. It is not even necessary, as in the puzzling case of leprosy, perhaps the most stigmatized of all diseases, although rarely fatal and extremely difficult to transmit. Cancer is more feared than heart disease, although someone who has had a coronary is more likely to die of heart disease in the next few years than someone who has cancer is likely to die of cancer. A heart attack is an event, but it does not give someone a new identity, turning the patient into one of them. It is not transforming, except in the sense of a transformation into something better. Inspired by fear, the cardiac patient acquires good habits of exercise and diet, starts to lead a more prudent, healthier life. And it is often thought to produce, if only because it can be instantaneous, an easy death. The most terrifying illnesses are those perceived not just as lethal, but as dehumanizing, literally so. What was expressed in the rabies phobia of 19th century France, with its countless pseudo-cases of contamination by animals newly turned bestial, and even of spontaneous rabies, actual cases of rabies, la rage, were extremely rare, was the fantasy that infection transformed people into maddened animals, unleashing uncontrollable, sexual, blasphemous impulses. Not the fact that it was indeed, until Pasteur's discovery of a treatment in 1885, invariably fatal. And while cholera killed fewer people in Western Europe in the 19th century than smallpox did, it was more feared, because of the suddenness with which it struck and the indignity of the symptoms. Fulminant diarrhea and vomiting, whose result anticipated the horror of post-mortem decomposition. Within several hours, radical dehydration shrank the patient into a wizened caricature of his or her former self. The skin turned bluish-black. Overwhelming, transfixing fear is still, in French, un peu bleu. The body became cold. Death followed the same day or soon after. Polio's effects could be horrifying. It withered the body, but it did not mark or rot the flesh. It was not repulsive. Further, polio affected the body only, though that may seem ruin enough. Not the face. The relatively appropriate, unmetaphorical reaction to polio owes much to the privileged status of the face, so determining of our evaluation of physical beauty and of physical ruin. All the debunking of the Cartesian separation of mind and body by modern philosophy and modern science has not reduced by one iota this culture's conviction of the separation of face and body, which influences every aspect of manners, fashion, sexual appreciation, aesthetic sensibility, virtually all our notions of appropriateness. This separation is a main point of one of European culture's principal iconographical traditions, the depiction of Christian martyrdom, with its astounding schism between what is inscribed on the face and what is happening to the body. Those innumerable images of Saint Sebastian, Saint Agatha, Saint Lawrence, but not of Christ himself, with the face demonstrating its effortless superiority to the atrocious things that are being inflicted down there. Below, the ruin of the body. Above, a person, incarnated in the face, who looks away, usually up, not registering pain or fear, already elsewhere. Only Christ, both Son of Man and Son of God, suffers in his face, has his passion. Our very notion of the person, of dignity, depends on the separation of face from body, on the possibility that the face may be exempt or exempt itself from what is happening to the body. And however lethal, illnesses like heart attacks and influenza that do not damage or deform the face never arouse the deepest dread. Not every kind of alteration to the face is perceived as repulsive or shaming. The most dreaded are those that seem like mutations into animality, the leper's lion face, or a kind of rot, as in syphilis. Underlying some of the moral judgments attached to disease are aesthetic judgments about the beautiful and the ugly, the clean and the unclean, the familiar and the alien or uncanny. More accurately, these are judgments that originate before the stage at which aesthetic and moral categories split apart, and eventually come to seem opposed. What counts more than the amount of disfigurement is that it reflects underlying, ongoing changes, the dissolution of the person. Smallpox also disfigures, pitting the face, but the marks of smallpox don't get worse. Indeed, they are precisely the stigmata of a survivor. The marks on the face of a leper, a syphilitic, someone with AIDS, are the signs of a progressive mutation, decomposition, something organic. Sinister characterizations of the organic proliferated in the 19th century to describe both the disease and its cause. Specific diseases, such as cholera, as well as the state of being generally prone to illness, were thought to be caused by an infected or foul atmosphere, effusions spontaneously generated from something unclean. Usually identified, first by its bad smell, as decaying organic matter, this disease-carrying atmosphere came to be identified with urban rather than rural squalor, and with garbage, rot, the proximity of cemeteries. These claims were eventually defeated by the discoveries by Pasteur and Koch of the role played by specific microorganisms. By 1880, the scientific community no longer believed in miasma, as these effusions were called, or in spontaneous generation. In 1883, a year after Koch discovered the tuberal bacillus, he discovered the waterborne bacillus that causes cholera. But even after the defeat of the miasmic theory by the germ theory of contagion, miasma lived on, shorn of its first-order causative status, as a kind of vague cofactor in the explanation of many illnesses. The conviction that living in dark, dirty cities causes, or at least produces a susceptibility to, tuberculosis, is a version of the miasma theory, and continued to be given credence well into this century, long after the actual cause of tuberculosis had been discovered. It seems that something like what is supplied by miasma, the generalizing of infection into an atmosphere, is required to moralize a disease. In the wake of its rejection by scientists, the theory inspired at least one great work of art. The opera Debussy made from Maeterlinck's play, Pelléas et Mélisande, a sort of Tristan und Isolde relocated in the world of miasma. It is right that Pelléas et Mélisande, in which everyone avows feelings of weakness and being lost, and some are already ailing, with its old decaying castle that lets in no light, where the ground is full of subterranean terrors and dank or watery depths into which one can fall, all the correlatives of miasma, minus the stench, seems to us supremely a portrait of psychological sickness, of neurosis. For precisely as the category of generic sickliness was phased out of 19th century medical thinking by the new understanding of the extreme specificity of what causes illness, it migrated to the expanding domain of psychology. This physically sickly person became the neurasthenic or neurotic person. And the idea of an organically contaminated, objectively pathogenic environment reappeared in the notion of a psychologically contaminated ambiance that produced a disposition to mental illness. The notion did not remain confined to the domain of psychology, and with psychology's new credibility as science, returned to re-influence medicine. The widely held view that many or even most diseases are not really physical, but mental, more conservatively, psychosomatic, perpetuates the form of the miasmic theory, with its surplus of causality, surplus of meaning, in a new version that has been extremely successful in the 20th century. The theory that psychological miasma, depression, funk, can cause physical illness has been tried out with varying degrees of respectability on many diseases, including cancer. And one way in which AIDS, some of whose metaphors overlap those of cancer, seems very different from cancer, That illness saturated with distinctively modern evaluations of energy and of disaster, and is experienced as a throwback to pre-modern diseases like leprosy and syphilis, is that no one is tempted, not yet at least, to psychologize it. 5. Plague is the principal metaphor by which the AIDS epidemic is understood. And because of AIDS, the popular misidentification of cancer as an epidemic, even a plague, seems to be receding. AIDS has banalized cancer. Plague, from the Latin plaga, stroke, wound, has long been used metaphorically as the highest standard of collective calamity, evil, scourge. Procopius, in his masterpiece of calumny, The Secret History, called the Emperor Justinian worse than the plague. Fewer escaped, as well as being a general name for many frightening diseases, although the disease to which the word is permanently affixed produced the most lethal of recorded epidemics, being experienced as a pitiless slayer is not necessary for a disease to be regarded as plague-like. Leprosy, very rarely fatal now, was not much more so when at its greatest epidemic strength, between about 1050 and 1350. And syphilis has been regarded as a plague. Blake speaks of the youthful harlot's curse that blights with plagues the marriage hearse, not because it killed often, but because it was disgracing, disempowering, disgusting. It is usually epidemics that are thought of as plagues, and these mass incidences of illness are understood as inflicted, not just endured. Considering illness as a punishment is the oldest idea of what causes illness, and an idea opposed by all attention to the ill that deserves the noble name of medicine. Hippocrates, who wrote several treatises on epidemics, specifically ruled out the wrath of God as a cause of bubonic plague. But the illnesses interpreted in antiquity as punishments, like the plague in Oedipus, were not thought to be shameful, as leprosy and subsequently syphilis were to be. Diseases, insofar as they acquired meaning, were collective calamities and judgments on a community. Only injuries and disabilities, not diseases, were thought of as individually merited. For an analogy in the literature of antiquity to the modern sense of a shaming, isolating disease, one would have to turn to Philoctetes and his stinking wound. The most feared diseases, those that are not simply fatal but transform the body into something alienating, like leprosy and syphilis and cholera, and, in the imagination of many, cancer, are the ones that seem particularly susceptible to promotion to plague. Leprosy and syphilis were the first illnesses to be consistently described as repulsive. It was syphilis that, in the earliest descriptions by doctors at the end of the 15th century, generated a version of the metaphors that flourish around AIDS, of a disease that was not only repulsive and retributive, but collectively invasive. Although Erasmus, the most influential European pedagogue of the early 16th century, described syphilis as nothing but a kind of leprosy, by 1529 he called it something worse than leprosy. It had already been understood as something different, because sexually transmitted. Paracelsus speaks, in Dunn's paraphrase, of that foul, contagious disease which then had invaded mankind in a few places, and since overflows in all, that for punishment of general licentiousness God first inflicted that disease. Thinking of syphilis as a punishment for an individual's transgression was for a long time, virtually until the disease became easily curable, not really distinct from regarding it as retribution for the licentiousness of a community, as with AIDS now in the rich industrial countries. In contrast to cancer, understood in a modern way as a disease incurred by and revealing of individuals, AIDS is understood in a pre-modern way as a disease incurred by people both as individuals and as members of a risk group, that neutral-sounding bureaucratic category which also revives the archaic idea of a tainted community that illness has judged. Not every account of plague or plague-like diseases, of course, is a vehicle for lurid stereotypes about illness and the ill. The effort to think critically, historically, about illness, about disaster generally, was attempted throughout the 18th century. say from Defoe's A Journal of the Plague Year, 1722, to Alessandro Manzoni's The Betrothed, 1827. Defoe's historical fiction, purporting to be an eyewitness account of bubonic plague in London in 1665, does not further any understanding of the plague as punishment, or a later part of the script as a transforming experience. And Manzoni, in his lengthy account of the passage of plague through the Duchy of Milan in 1630, is avowedly committed to presenting a more accurate, less reductive view than his historical sources. But even these two complex narratives reinforce some of the perennial, simplifying ideas about plague. One feature of the usual script for plague, the disease invariably comes from somewhere else. The names for syphilis, when it began its epidemic sweep through Europe in the last decade of the 15th century, are an exemplary illustration of the need to make a dreaded disease foreign. It was the French pox to the English, Morbus Germanicus to the Parisians, the Naples sickness to the Florentines, the Chinese disease to the Japanese. But what may seem like a joke about the inevitability of chauvinism reveals a more important truth, that there is a link between imagining disease and imagining foreignness. It lies perhaps in the very concept of wrong, which is archaically identical with the non-us, the alien. A polluting person is always wrong, as Mary Douglas has observed. The inverse is also true. A person judged to be wrong is regarded as, at least potentially, a source of pollution. The foreign place of origin of important illnesses, as of drastic changes in the weather, may be no more remote than a neighboring country. Illness is a species of invasion, and indeed is often carried by soldiers. Manzoni's account of the plague of 1630, chapters 31 to 37, begins, "The plague which the Tribunal of Health had feared might enter the Milanese provinces with the German troops had, in fact, entered, as is well known, and it is also well known that it did not stop there, but went on to invade and depopulate a large part of Italy." Defoe's chronicle of the plague of 1665 begins similarly, with a flurry of ostentatiously scrupulous speculation about its foreign origin. "It was about the beginning of September 1664 that I, among the rest of my neighbors, heard in ordinary discourse that the plague was returned again in Holland, for it had been very violent there, and particularly at Amsterdam and Rotterdam in the year 1663, whither, they say, it was brought, some said from Italy, others from the Levant, among some goods which were brought home by their Turkey fleet. Others said it was brought from Candia, others from Cyprus. It mattered not from whence it came, but all agreed it was come into Holland again." The bubonic plague that reappeared in London in the 1720s had arrived from Marseille, which was where plague in the 18th century was usually thought to enter Western Europe, brought by seamen, then transported by soldiers and merchants. By the 19th century, the foreign origin was usually more exotic, the means of transport less specifically imagined, and the illness itself had become phantasmagorical, symbolic. At the end of Crime and Punishment, Raskolnikov dreams of plague. He dreamt that the whole world was condemned to a terrible, new, strange plague that had come to Europe from the depths of Asia. At the beginning of the sentence, it is the whole world, which turns out by the end of the sentence to be Europe, afflicted by a lethal visitation from Asia. Dostoevsky's model is undoubtedly cholera, called Asiatic cholera, long endemic in Bengal, which had rapidly become, and remained through most of the 19th century, a worldwide epidemic disease. Part of the centuries-old conception of Europe as a privileged cultural entity is that it is a place which is colonized by lethal diseases coming from elsewhere. Europe is assumed to be by rights free of disease. And Europeans have been astoundingly callous about the far more devastating extent to which they, as invaders, as colonists, have introduced their lethal diseases to the exotic, primitive world. Think of the ravages of smallpox, influenza, and cholera on the aboriginal populations of the Americas and Australia. The tenacity of the connection of exotic origin with dreaded disease is one reason why cholera, of which there were four great outbreaks in Europe in the 19th century, each with a lower death toll than the preceding one, has continued to be more memorable than smallpox, whose ravages increased as the century went on. 500,000 died in the European smallpox pandemic of the early 1870s, but which could not be construed as plague-like, a disease with a non-European origin. Plagues are no longer sent, as in biblical and Greek antiquity, for the question of agency has blurred. Instead, peoples are visited by plagues, and the visitations recur, as is taken for granted in the subtitle of Defoe's narrative, which explains that it is about that which happened in London during the last great visitation in 1665. Even for non-Europeans, lethal disease may be called a visitation, but a visitation on them is invariably described as different from one on us. I believe that about one half of the whole people was carried off by this visitation, wrote the English traveler Alexander Kinglake, reaching Cairo at a time of the bubonic plague, sometimes called Oriental plague. The Orientals, however, have more quiet fortitude than Europeans under afflictions of this sort. Kinglake's influential book, Eofin, 1844, suggestively subtitled Traces of Travel Brought Home from the East, illustrates many of the enduring Eurocentric presumptions about others, starting from the fantasy that peoples with little reason to expect exemption from misfortune have a lessened capacity to feel misfortune. Thus, it is believed that Asians, or the poor, or blacks, or Africans, or Muslims, don't suffer or don't grieve as Europeans or whites do. The fact that illness is associated with the poor, who are, from the perspective of the privileged, aliens in one's midst, reinforces the association of illness with the foreign, with an exotic, often primitive place. Thus, illustrating the classic script for plague, AIDS is thought to have started in the Dark Continent, then spread to Haiti, then to the United States and to Europe, then it is understood as a tropical disease, another infestation from the so-called Third World, which is, after all, where most people in the world live, as well as a scourge of the triste tropique. Africans who detect racist stereotypes in much of the speculation about the geographical origin of AIDS are not wrong. Nor are they wrong in thinking that depictions of Africa as the cradle of AIDS must feed anti-African prejudices in Europe and Asia. The subliminal connection made to notions about a primitive past and the many hypotheses that have been fielded about possible transmission from animals, a disease of green monkeys, African swine fever, cannot help but activate a familiar set of stereotypes about animality, sexual license, and blacks. In Zaire and other countries in Central Africa, where AIDS is killing tens of thousands, the counter-reaction has begun. Many doctors, academics, journalists, government officials, and other educated people believe that the virus was sent to Africa from the United States, an act of bacteriological warfare, whose aim was to decrease the African birth rate, which got out of hand and has returned to afflict its perpetrators. A common African version of this belief about the disease's provenance has the virus fabricated in a CIA Army laboratory in Maryland, sent from there to Africa, and brought back to its country of origin by American homosexual missionaries returning from Africa to Maryland. At first it was assumed that AIDS must become widespread elsewhere, in the same catastrophic form in which it has emerged in Africa, and those who still think this will eventually happen invariably invoke the Black Death. The plague metaphor is an essential vehicle of the most pessimistic reading of the epidemiological prospects. From classic fiction to the latest journalism, the standard plague story is of inexorability, inescapability. The unprepared are taken by surprise. Those observing the recommended precautions are struck down as well. All succumb when the story is told by an omniscient narrator, as in Poe's parable, The Mask of the Red Death, 1842, inspired by an account of a ball held in Paris during the cholera epidemic of 1832. Almost all, if the story is told from the point of view of a traumatized witness, who will be a benumbed survivor, as in Jean Giono's Stendhalian novel Horseman on the Roof, 1951, in which a young Italian nobleman in exile wanders through cholera-stricken southern France in the 1830s. Plagues are invariably regarded as judgments on society, and the metaphoric inflation of AIDS into such a judgment also accustoms people to the inevitability of global spread. This is a traditional use of sexually transmitted diseases to be described as punishments, not just of individuals, but of a group. General licentiousness. Not only venereal diseases have been used in this way to identify transgressing or vicious populations. Interpreting any catastrophic epidemic as a sign of moral laxity or political decline was as common until the later part of the last century as associating dreaded diseases with foreignness or with despised and feared minorities. And the assignment of fault is not contradicted by cases that do not fit. The Methodist preachers in England who connected the cholera epidemic of 1832 with drunkenness, the temperance movement was just starting, were not understood to be claiming that everybody who got cholera was a drunkard. There is always room for innocent victims. Children, young women. Tuberculosis, in its identity as a disease of the poor, rather than of the sensitive, was also linked by late 19th century reformers to alcoholism. Responses to illnesses associated with sinners and the poor invariably recommended the adoption of middle-class values, the regular habits, productivity, and emotional self-control to which drunkenness was thought the chief impediment. Health itself was eventually identified with these values, which were religious as well as mercantile, health being evidence of virtue, as disease was of depravity. The dictum that cleanliness is next to godliness is to be taken quite literally. The succession of cholera epidemics in the 19th century shows a steady waning of religious interpretations of the disease. More precisely, these increasingly coexisted with other explanations. Although, by the time of the epidemic of 1866, cholera was commonly understood not simply as a divine punishment, but as the consequence of remediable defects of sanitation, it was still regarded as the scourge of the sinful. A writer in the New York Times declared, April 22, 1866, "Cholera is especially the punishment of neglect of sanitary laws. It is the curse of the dirty, the intemperate, and the degraded." That it now seems unimaginable for cholera or a similar disease to be regarded in this way signifies not a lessened capacity to moralize about diseases, but only a change in the kind of illnesses that are used didactically. Cholera was perhaps the last major epidemic disease fully qualifying for plague status for almost a century. I mean cholera as a European and American, therefore a 19th century disease. Until 1817, there had never been a cholera epidemic outside the Far East. Influenza, which would seem more plague-like than any other epidemic in this century, if loss of life were the main criterion, and which struck as suddenly as cholera and killed as quickly, usually in a few days, was never viewed metaphorically as a plague, nor was a more recent epidemic, polio. One reason why plague notions were not invoked is that these epidemics did not have enough of the attributes perennially ascribed to plagues. For instance, polio was construed as typically a disease of children, of the innocent. The more important reason is that there has been a shift in the focus of the moralistic exploitation of illness. This shift, to diseases that can be interpreted as judgments on the individual, makes it harder to use epidemic disease as such. For a long time, cancer was the illness that best fitted this secular culture's need to blame and punish and censor through the imagery of disease. Cancer was a disease of an individual, and understood as the result not of an action, but rather of a failure to act, to be prudent, to exert proper self-control, or to be properly expressive. In the 20th century, it has become almost impossible to moralize about epidemics, except those which are transmitted sexually. The persistence of the belief that illness reveals and is a punishment for moral laxity or turpitude can be seen in another way, by noting the persistence of descriptions of disorder or corruption as a disease. So indispensable has been the plague metaphor in bringing summary judgments about social crisis that its use hardly abated during the era when collective diseases were no longer treated so moralistically, the time between the influenza and encephalitis pandemics of the early and mid-1920s, and the acknowledgement of a new mysterious epidemic illness in the early 1980s, and when great infectious epidemics were so often and confidently proclaimed a thing of the past. The plague metaphor was common in the 1930s as a synonym for social and psychic catastrophe. Evocations of plague of this type usually go with rant, with anti-liberal attitudes. Think of Artaud on theater and plague, of Wilhelm Reich on emotional plague. And such a generic diagnosis necessarily promotes anti-historical thinking. A theodicy, as well as a demonology, it not only stipulates something emblematic of evil, but makes this the bearer of a rough, terrible justice. In Karl Čapek's The White Plague, 1937, the loathsome pestilence that has appeared in a state where fascism has come to power afflicts only those over the age of 40, those who could be held morally responsible. Written on the eve of the Nazi takeover of Czechoslovakia, Čapek's allegorical play is something of an anomaly. The use of the plague metaphor to convey the menace of what is defined as barbaric by a mainstream European liberal. The play's mysterious, grisly malady is something like leprosy, a rapid, invariably fatal leprosy that is supposed to have come, of course, from Asia. But Čapek is not interested in identifying political evil with the incursion of the foreign. He scores his didactic points by focusing not on the disease itself, but on the management of information about it by scientists, journalists, and politicians. The most famous specialist in the disease harangues a reporter. The disease of the hour, you might say. A good 5 million have died of it to date. 20 million have it, and at least 3 times as many are going about their business, blithely unaware of the marble-like, marble-sized spots on their bodies. Chides a fellow doctor for using the popular terms the White Plague and Peking Leprosy, instead of the scientific name the Chung Syndrome, fantasizes about how his clinic's work on identifying the new virus and finding a cure. Every clinic in the world has an intensive research program, will add to the prestige of science and win a Nobel Prize for its discoverer, revels in hyperbole when it is thought a cure has been found. It was the most dangerous disease in all history, worse than the bubonic plague, and outlines plans for sending those with symptoms to well-guarded detention camps. Given that every carrier of the disease is a potential spreader of the disease, we must protect the uncontaminated from the contaminated. All sentimentality in this regard is fatal, and therefore criminal. However cartoonish Čapek's ironies may seem, they are a not improbable sketch of catastrophe, medical, ecological, as a managed public event in modern mass society. And however conventionally he deploys the plague metaphor, as an agency of retribution, in the end the plague strikes down the dictator himself. Čapek's feel for public relations leads him to make explicit in the play the understanding of disease as a metaphor. The eminent doctor declares the accomplishments of science to be as nothing compared with the merits of the dictator, about to launch a war, who has averted a far worse scourge, the scourge of anarchy, the leprosy of corruption, the epidemic of barbaric liberty, the plague of social disintegration fatally sapping the organism of our nation. Camus' The Plague, which appeared a decade later, is a far less literal use of plague by another great European liberal. As subtle as Čapek's The White Plague is schematic. Camus' novel is not, as is sometimes said, a political allegory in which the outbreak of bubonic plague in a Mediterranean port city represents the Nazi occupation. This plague is not retributive. Camus is not protesting anything, not corruption or tyranny, not even mortality. The plague is no more or less than an exemplary event, the eruption of death that gives life its seriousness. His use of plague, more epitome than metaphor, is detached, stoic, aware. It is not about bringing judgment. But as in Čapek's play, characters in Camus' novel declare how unthinkable it is to have a plague in the 20th century, as if the belief that such a calamity could not happen anymore, means that it must. 6. The emergence of a new catastrophic epidemic, when for several decades it had been confidently assumed that such calamities belonged to the past, would not be enough to revive the moralistic inflation of an epidemic into a plague. It was necessary that the epidemic be one whose most common means of transmission is sexual. Cotton Mather called syphilis a punishment which the just judgment of God has reserved for our late ages. Recalling this and other nonsense uttered about syphilis from the end of the 15th to the early 20th centuries, one should hardly be surprised that many want to view AIDS metaphorically as plague-like, a moral judgment on society. Professional fulminators can't resist the rhetorical opportunity offered by a sexually transmitted disease that is lethal. Thus, the fact that AIDS is predominantly a heterosexually transmitted illness in the countries where it first emerged in epidemic form has not prevented such guardians of public morals as Jesse Helms and Norman Podhoretz from depicting it as a visitation specially aimed at and deservedly incurred by Western homosexuals, while another Reagan-era celebrity, Pat Buchanan, orates about AIDS and moral bankruptcy, and Jerry Falwell offers the generic diagnosis that AIDS is God's judgment on a society that does not live by his rules. What is surprising is not that the AIDS epidemic has been exploited in this way, but that such cant has been confined to so predictable a sector of bigots. The official discourse about AIDS invariably includes admonitions against bigotry. The pronouncements of those who claim to speak for God can mostly be discounted as the rhetoric regularly prompted by sexually transmitted illness. From Cotton Mather's judgment to recent statements by two leading Brazilian clerics, Bishop Falcao of Brasilia, who declares AIDS to be the consequence of moral decadence, and the Cardinal of Rio de Janeiro, Eugenio Salles, who wants it both ways, describing AIDS as God's punishment and as the revenge of nature. More interesting, because their purposes are more complex, are the secular sponsors of this sort of invective. Authoritarian political ideologies have a vested interest in promoting fear, a sense of the imminence of takeover by aliens, and real diseases are useful material. Epidemic diseases usually elicit a call to ban the entry of foreigners, immigrants, and xenophobic propaganda has always depicted immigrants as bearers of disease. In the late 19th century, cholera, yellow fever, typhoid fever, tuberculosis. It seems logical that the political figure in France who represents the most extreme nativist, racist views, Jean-Marie Le Pen, has attempted a strategy of fomenting fear of this new alien peril, insisting that AIDS is not just infectious, but contagious, and calling for mandatory nationwide testing and the quarantine of everyone carrying the virus. And AIDS is a gift to the present regime in South Africa, whose foreign minister declared recently, evoking the incidence of the illness among the mine workers imported from neighboring all-black countries, "The terrorists are now coming to us with a weapon more terrible than Marxism, AIDS." The AIDS epidemic serves as an ideal projection for first-world political paranoia. Not only is the so-called AIDS virus the quintessential invader from the Third World, it can stand for any mythological menace. In this country, AIDS has so far evoked less pointedly racist reactions than in Europe, including the Soviet Union, where the African origin of the disease is stressed. Here, it is as much a reminder of feelings associated with the menace of the Second World as it is an image of being overrun by the Third. Predictably, the public voices in this country most committed to drawing moral lessons from the AIDS epidemic, such as Norman Podhoretz, are those whose main theme is worry about America's will to maintain its bellicosity, its expenditures on armaments, its firm anti-communist stance, and who find everywhere evidence of the decline of American political and imperial authority. Denunciations of the gay plague are part of a much larger complaint, common among anti-liberals in the West and many exiles from the Russian bloc, about contemporary permissiveness of all kinds, a now familiar diatribe against the soft West, with its hedonism, its vulgar, sexy music, its indulgence in drugs, its disabled family life, which have sapped the will to stand up to communism. AIDS is a favorite concern of those who translate their political agenda into questions of group psychology, of national self-esteem and self-confidence. Although these specialists in ugly feelings insist that AIDS is a punishment for deviant sex, what moves them is not just or even principally homophobia. Even more important is the utility of AIDS in pursuing one of the main activities of the so-called neoconservatives, the Kulturkampf against all that is called, for short and inaccurately, the 1960s. A whole politics of the will, of intolerance, of paranoia, of fear of political weakness, has fastened on this disease. AIDS is such an apt goad to familiar, consensus-building fears that have been cultivated for several generations, like fear of subversion, and to fears that have surfaced more recently, of uncontrollable pollution and of unstoppable migration from the Third World, that it would seem inevitable that AIDS be envisaged in this society as something total, civilization-threatening. And raising the disease's metaphorical stature by keeping alive fears of its easy transmissibility, its imminent spread, does not diminish its status as mainly a consequence of illicit acts or of economic and cultural backwardness. That it is a punishment for deviant behavior and that it threatens the innocent, these two notions about AIDS are hardly in contradiction. Such is the extraordinary potency and efficacy of the plague metaphor. It allows a disease to be regarded both as something incurred by vulnerable others and as, potentially, everyone's disease. Still, it is one thing to emphasize how the disease menaces everybody in order to incite fear and confirm prejudice, quite another to argue, in order to defuse prejudice and reduce stigma, that eventually AIDS will, directly or indirectly, affect everybody. Recently, these same mythologists who have been eager to use AIDS for ideological mobilization against deviants have backed away from the most panic-inspiring estimates of the illness. They are among the most vocal of those who insist that infection will not spread to the general population, and have turned their attention to denouncing hysteria or frenzy about AIDS. Behind what they now consider the excessive publicity given the disease, they discern the desire to placate an all-powerful minority by agreeing to regard their disease as ours, further evidence of the sway of nefarious liberal values and of America's spiritual decline. Making AIDS everyone's problem, and therefore a subject on which everyone needs to be educated, charge the anti-liberal AIDS mythologists, subverts our understanding of the difference between us and them. Indeed, exculpates or at least makes irrelevant moral judgments about them. In such rhetoric, the disease continues to be identified almost exclusively with homosexuality, and specifically the practice of sodomy. Has America become a country where classroom discussion of the Ten Commandments is impermissible, but teacher instructions in safe sodomy are to be mandatory? Inquires Pat Buchanan, protesting the foolish proposal made in the report of the recent Presidential Commission on the Epidemic, chaired by Admiral Watkins, to outlaw discrimination against people with AIDS. Not the disease, but the appeals heard from the most official quarters to set aside prejudice and fear in favor of compassion, the words of the Watkins report, have become a principal target, suggesting, as they do, a weakening of this society's power, or willingness to punish and segregate through judgments about sexual behavior. More than cancer, but rather like syphilis, AIDS seems to foster ominous fantasies about a disease that is a marker of both individual and social vulnerabilities. The virus invades the body. The disease, or in the newer version, the fear of the disease, is described as invading the whole society. In late 1986, President Reagan pronounced AIDS to be spreading, insidiously, of course, through the length and breadth of our society. But AIDS, while the pretext for expressing dark intimations about the body politic, has yet to seem credible as a political metaphor for internal enemies, even in France, where AIDS, in French le sida, was quickly added to the store of political invective. Le Pen has dismissed some of his opponents as AIDS-ish, sidatique, and the anti-liberal polemicist Louis Poels said that lycée students on strike last year were suffering from mental AIDS, sont atteints d'un sida mental. Neither has AIDS proved of much use as a metaphor for international political evil. True, Jean Kirkpatrick once couldn't resist comparing international terrorism to AIDS, but such sallies are rare. Perhaps because for that purpose, the cancer metaphor has proved so fecund. This doesn't mean that AIDS is not used, preposterously, as a metaphor, but only that AIDS has a metaphoric potential different from that of cancer. When the movie director in Alain Tonnerre's film La Vallée Fantôme, 1987, uses cinema is like a cancer, and then corrects himself, no, it's infectious, it's more like AIDS, the comparison seems lumberingly self-conscious, as well as a decided underuse of AIDS. Not its infectiousness, but its characteristic latency offers a more distinctive use of AIDS as a metaphor. Thus, the Palestinian-Israeli writer Anton Shamas in the Jerusalem Weekly Kol Ha'ir, in a fit of medical, sexual, and political fantasy, recently described Israel's Declaration of Independence of 1948 as the AIDS of the Jewish state in the land of Israel, whose long incubation has produced Gush Emunim and Rabbi Meir Kahana. That is where it all began, and that is where it will all end. AIDS, I am sorry to say, despite my sympathy for homosexuals, affects mainly monoerotics, and a mononational Jewish state contains, by definition, the seeds of its own destruction, the collapse of the political immune system that we call democracy. Rock Hudson, who once was as beautiful as a Paul Mochnik, now lies dying long after the dissolution of the Paul Mock. The state of Israel, for Jews, of course, was indeed once beautiful. And even more promising than its connection with latency is the potential of AIDS as a metaphor for contamination and mutation. Cancer is still common as a metaphor for what is feared or deplored, even if the illness is less dreaded than before. If AIDS can eventually be drafted for comparable use, it will be because AIDS is not only invasive, a trait it shares with cancer, or even because it is infectious, but because of the specific imagery that surrounds viruses. Virology supplies a new set of medical metaphors independent of AIDS, which nevertheless reinforce the AIDS mythology. It was years before AIDS that William Burroughs oracularly declared, and Laurie Anderson echoed, language is a virus, and the viral explanation is invoked more and more often. Until recently, most of the infections recognized as viral were ones, like rabies and influenza, that have very rapid effects. But the category of slow-acting viral infections is growing. Many progressive and invariably fatal disorders of the central nervous system, and some degenerative diseases of the brain that can appear in old age, as well as the so-called autoimmune diseases, are now suspected of being, in fact, slow virus diseases. And evidence continues to accumulate for a viral cause of at least some human cancers. Notions of conspiracy translate well into metaphors of implacable, insidious, infinitely patient viruses. In contrast to bacteria, which are relatively complex organisms, viruses are described as an extremely primitive form of life. At the same time, their activities are far more complex than those envisaged in the earlier germ models of infection. Viruses are not simply agents of infection, contamination. They transport genetic information, they transform cells, and they themselves, many of them, evolve. While the smallpox virus appears to stay constant for centuries, influenza viruses evolve so rapidly that vaccines need to be modified every year to keep up with changes in the surface coat of the virus. The virus, or more accurately, viruses thought to cause AIDS, are at least as mutable as the influenza viruses. Indeed, virus is now a synonym for change. Linda Ronstadt, recently explaining why she prefers doing Mexican folk music to rock and roll, observed, We don't have any tradition in contemporary music except change. Mutate, like a virus. So far as plague still has a future as a metaphor, it is through the ever more familiar notion of the virus. Perhaps no disease in the future caused by a bacillus will be considered as plague-like. Information itself, now inextricably linked to the powers of computers, is threatened by something compared to a virus. Rogue or pirate programs, known as software viruses, are described as paralleling the behavior of biological viruses, which can capture the genetic code of parts of an organism and affect transfers of alien genetic material. These programs, deliberately planted onto a floppy disk meant to be used with the computer, or introduced when the computer is communicating over telephone lines or data networks with other computers, copy themselves onto the computer's operating system. Like their biological namesakes, they won't produce immediate signs of damage to the computer's memory, which gives the newly infected program time to spread to other computers. Such metaphors drawn from virology, partly stimulated by the omnipresence of talk of AIDS, are turning up everywhere. The virus that destroyed a considerable amount of data at the Student Computer Center at Lehigh University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, in 1987, was given the name PC-AIDS. In France, computer specialists already speak of the problem of la sida informatique, and they reinforce the sense of the omnipresence of AIDS. It is perhaps not surprising that the newest transforming element in the modern world, computers, should be borrowing metaphors drawn from our newest transforming illness. Nor is it surprising that descriptions of the course of viral infection now echo the language of the computer age, as when it is said that a virus will normally produce new copies of itself. In addition to the mechanistic descriptions, the way viruses are animistically characterized, as a menace in waiting, as mutable, as furtive, as biologically innovative, reinforces the sense that a disease can be something ingenious, unpredictable, novel. These metaphors are central to ideas about AIDS that distinguish this illness from others that have been regarded as plague-like. For though the fears AIDS represents are old, its status as that unexpected event, an entirely new disease, a new judgment, as it were, adds to the dread. 7. Some will allow no diseases to be new. Others think that many old ones are ceased, and that such which are esteemed new will have but their time. However, the mercy of God hath scattered the great heap of diseases, and not loaded any one country with all. Some may be new in one country, which have been old in another. New discoveries of the earth discover new diseases. And if Asia, Africa, and America should bring in their list, Pandora's box would swell, and there must be a strange pathology. Sir Thomas Browne, a letter to a friend upon occasion of the death of his intimate friend. It is, of course, unlikely that AIDS, first identified in the early 1980s, is a new disease. Most probably, the virus has been around a long time, and not only in Africa, though it is only recently, and in Africa, that the disease has attained epidemic volume. But for general consciousness, it is a new disease, and for medicine, too. AIDS marks a turning point in current attitudes toward illness and medicine, as well as toward sexuality and toward catastrophe. Medicine had been viewed as an age-old military campaign, now nearing its final phase, leading to victory. The emergence of a new epidemic disease, when for several decades it had been confidently assumed that such calamities belonged to the past, has inevitably changed the status of medicine. The advent of AIDS has made it clear that the infectious diseases are far from conquered, and their roster far from closed. Medicine changed mores. Illness is changing them back. Contraception and the assurance by medicine of the easy curability of sexually transmitted diseases, as of almost all infectious diseases, made it possible to regard sex as an adventure without consequences. Now AIDS obliges people to think of sex as having, possibly, the direst consequences, suicide or murder. There was a trial run for the conversion of sexuality to something dangerous in the widely diffused panic about herpes in the United States in the early 1980s, And herpes in most cases is merely awful, erotically disqualifying. The fear of AIDS imposes on an act whose ideal is an experience of pure presentness and a creation of the future, a relationship